Welcome back to the program. If nothing else is clear about this year's presidential election, it's certain that our economy and our current forms of capitalism are going to be on trial. From the early rhetoric of the campaign to the Occupy and Tea Party movements, the success of Ron Paul, and even a recent piece by Larry Summers in the Financial Times assessing the state of capitalism, all prove that our current systems and institutions are seeing pressures as never before. But how will all of this play out? Will we be asking the right questions? And will the politics keep up with the reality of technology and our changing interconnected world? These are just some of the questions asked by our guest, Gar Alperwitz, in his new book, America Beyond Capitalism. Gar Alperwitz is the Lionel Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. It is my pleasure to welcome him to the program to talk about America Beyond Capitalism, reclaiming our wealth, our liberty, and our democracy. Gar Alperwitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you here. We've certainly had debates and elections center around economic issues for a long time, but there's something different about this discussion. It goes to the very fundamentals of the economic system that we have. Talk a little about that.
Well, I think the what's interesting about the new times is that people, and I think for the first time in certainly my adult lifetime, have a sense that there is something profoundly wrong, not just politically wrong. Something's going on in that's systemic, that Washington cannot make decisions. The economy stagnates and decays. Other countries are advancing while we stumble and flounder. The awareness, and as a historian, it's a really an important moment when large numbers of people begin asking questions about why is something going wrong. And I think that's, number one, the most important political phenomenon. It doesn't mean that we know forward how to move forward. I think the political debate is stuck in the traditional, really obsolete categories about the conservatives cut the budget deficits. Liberals, and I come out of the progressive liberal tradition historically, but still saying let's do the same thing, spend more money to boost the economy, social programs. I'm for all of that, but we know, and I think even most progressives know, that we're stuck in a pattern that doesn't get us advances. At best, we're kind of trying to hold the line, moving backwards as things get worse economically and socially. So it's a big time when we begin to ask questions about where are we going. What is the future? Is there a future beyond this kind of system? Is there an America beyond capitalism, which is the question of my book, a long-term direction that we may have to take?
Is the core of this fundamental changes that have taken place in the nature of the economy as a result of technology, of globalization, the way people work? Have all of those fundamental shifts, in fact, created this situation?
There have been major changes in the way the economy is organized. Globalization has undercut American wages and undercut American unions. But the technological changes are, in a sense, they're all positive. That is to say, this is an extremely rich country. Even now, you could divide the economy up for every family of four, and you'd come out with just a little bit under $200,000 for everybody per family of four. So it isn't in the technology, it's in how we manage and distribute and organize ourselves. And that's what's faltering. The way in which we run the economic system is producing, you know, if you count everybody who given up work and given up looking for work, we're still at 16 to 18% unemployment, maybe more. So we're organizing the economy in ways that maldistribute time and work. And at the same time, we give, you know, 1% at the top having more income than the bottom 50 to 60%. I mean, ridiculous, absurd ways of organizing ourselves that just are resisted by the political system. So there's a stalemate in the way the structure of both the economy, but above all how the politics allows us to manage an extremely rich economy is faltering. And I think that's the issue that poses the question, is there, as I say, an America that's beyond capitalism and indeed beyond the traditional socialist models? In my book, I attempt to say, I think we're stuck now, but I think this is the time when people are really beginning to experiment just below the horizon with the city banks and state banks and worker-owned companies and the whole raft of things that the press doesn't cover that point to something that's really a new model beyond what we've been traditionally looking at.
How important is it to try and understand how we got to this point in terms of this wage gap that you're talking about, the income disparity? How important is it to really bear down and try and understand the steps along the way, the tipping points along the way that got us here?
I think it's absolutely critical, because it by doing that, you begin to see why really some new direction is absolutely essential. Let me give a shot at a very brief description from, you know, that's in this, it's in a book, in the book, America Beyond Capitalism. It goes like this. First, the power throughout the world of traditional progressive strategies, which is mainly organized around the core power of American labor unions, and labor unions around the world are the muscle that have given progressive politics their force. Well, that muscle in the United States, partly because of globalization, but partly for attack by corporate leaders, and partly for the inherent weakness of the labor movement, we are much weaker than most countries. We've gone from 35%, 34.5% of the labor force just at the peak. We're down to 11% of organized labor membership in the unions now, and really in the private sector, it's 6 to 7. So the organizational and institutional muscle has really decayed behind any form of traditional progressive politics, and the balance of power has shifted in the direction of the corporation and the elites. I think we could go through how that happened over time, but I think that's the most important single thing to look at, because it tells you that unless we build a new institutional power base to go along with labor, I'm very supportive of the traditional model, but unless we build new institutions that displace corporate power, build an alternative vision, build alternative economic power, we are going to be going backwards continuously, because the underlying power base has changed radically. And that's why some of these new co-ops and worker-owned institutions and the things that are bubbling beneath the surface point towards really changing ownership patterns that give us also the possibility of greater power and democratizing both ownership and power. And I think that's the thing the press doesn't cover, and why I wrote America Beyond Capitalism, to say, hey, look, if you look around, there's an enormous amount going on, in good part because of the pain levels are building up, but also it suggests a different future and a different slow, step-by-step power base, something like what was done in the two decades before the New Deal in the so-called laboratories of democracy at the state and local level, building up step-by-step. There are, you know, something like 13 million people involved in worker-owned companies, press doesn't cover. There are 130 million people involved in co-ops or co-op credit unions, different form of ownership the press doesn't cover. States, the state of North Dakota has a state bank. 15 states are considering setting up a public bank. Many cities are doing that. There are 2,000 public utilities. There's a whole range of ways in which economic power is being reorganized around democratic ownership structures that are different from the power structure that dominates, the 1% in America owns just about half of the investment capital. 5% owns 70%. So there's a different pattern in these quietly developing things at the grassroots level that I think suggests a different future if you take the long view of, the way the civil rights workers in the 1930s and 40s said, now's the time to build the base for what will come and what came in the 60s. And I think that's what's happening at the grassroots level and really pointing towards something different for the future.
What do we learn, both positive and negatively, from what's gone on in Europe, Germany notwithstanding at the moment, where the labor unions have certainly been a more powerful force, but it has bred a different kind of economic problem?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because you're talking about very different political contexts. If you take the Swedish model, which is the most extreme, unlike here, where we're now down to 11% of the labor force, at the peak in Sweden, 80% was organized, and now it's in the 50 and 60% range. So they were able to hold the line in a certain way and balance and negotiate with corporate power and try to come out with a better deal for both sides, a better welfare state, but also a more refined and better regulatory structure for the corporate system. That's just not possible here. I think the difficulties going on in Europe, though, are at the center, countries like Europe, Germany and France, are trying to preserve their essentially dominant manufacturing role within the periphery, which includes Greece and Spain and Portugal and some of the other, Ireland, they're trying to maintain that. In a way, unfortunately, cutting back spending, which means that they're losing their market. It's very similar to here, that this, they don't quite accept the idea. They'd like to cut spending, but they don't quite accept the idea that if you do that, you don't have any consumers. And then you have a real problem that goes well beyond the banking system, well beyond finance, because you move deeper into recession. So they're stuck in an odd way. It's as if you took the industrial Midwest, drew a circle around it, and said, we're going to deal with the rest of the country. That's Germany dealing with Greece and Portugal, but they have a national boundary around it. And if they try to, you know, squeeze the externals, get the Greeks to cut back more and more, they don't have anybody to sell to. And I think that's where the trouble they're facing.
Talk a little bit about young people here and how they're responding to these issues. Because on the one hand, we see many of them attracted to, invested in the Occupy movement. And on the other hand, we see an equally large number attracted to and invested in somebody like Ron Paul.
Well, I think the judgment that there's something profoundly wrong in the political economic system, and something profoundly wrong in Wall Street, the Tea Party is as angry at the bankers as Occupy is, that there's something profoundly wrong with the way the whole system is set up. That is a shared understanding, and I think it's correct. That is to say, the power structure there is a profound difficulty which manifests itself in unemployment or in extraordinary financial gains for tiny little groups at the top, many, many things. The Tea Party takes it in the direction of, well, a plague in all your houses, let's get rid of Washington and hope that the free market can be reestablished in a 19th century idea, which I think is just simply kind of a throwback idea. But the revulsion at Washington and the lobbyists and the way and the corporate structure and their revulsion at welfare, which is, that's a questionable part of what they're talking about, which obviously that isn't why. Those are not the people who created the problem. That's one piece of it. On the other side, people sensing, you know, Occupy Wall Street, that these bankers who created trillions of dollars in public costs and trillions of dollars in suffering by the unemployment and the recession, and then running away with gigantic bonuses and federal bailouts with taxpayer money, obviously something wrong with that. So that is a shared recognition from really two sides of the divide that there's something wrong with the way things, with business as usual. Now, I don't think the Tea Party offers any answer whatsoever. I think it's a truly reactionary, that it's the throwback to the past, but it's onto something, that there's something wrong. And I think the progressive side is struggling with attempting really to do the best you can with traditional ideas, so try to regulate them better when we know they've got enough power to slip out from under the regulators and rewrite the rules as the bankers are doing today. Try to tax them more when we know we can only get a little bit more, but whatever we can get is good. Try to spend more in social programs when we know that's delayed and stuck. I'm for that direction, but I think clearly that's at something of a dead end. And that's the time in history when really new directions have to begin to be forced. And what America Beyond Capitalism is about is the beginning points of a real serious debate about, if you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want and is there a way to get there? And what is encouraging is at the grassroots level, where the press doesn't cover it, and as I say, I tried to write America Beyond Capitalism to report on this, there is a whole developing strategy that it looks different from all of the above, and it's very decentralized, but its dominant feature is democratic ownership of productive wealth. So instead of the 1% owning 50% of the investment capital, what you get is worker-owned co-ops. You know, 5 or 6 million more people are involved in worker-owned companies of one kind or another than are members of unions in the private sector, but the press doesn't cover it, and it's a developing trend. As I said, many cities are beginning to look at city banks and public utilities, another way of reorganizing ownership to a different public. The large number of at the state level that the insurance companies are moving towards, the state insurance companies, we call it single payer. There are 15 to 20 states that are thinking about and are looking at legislation for state single going to see more of this as the pain level develops. And it's a democratizing of ownership, but very decentralized, and it's quite new. It's different from socialism or capitalism, but it moves in the direction of a very democratic American and a very American vision, and national programs as well. I think what's going to happen at the national level, we're going to see the big banks are going to, you know, cause another financial crisis. Almost every expert believes that will happen, and at some point they'll try to break them up. And then they will regroup. The big fish will eat the little fish, and they'll come right back to the trough. And at that point, I suspect at some point there's going to be a takeover of some of these really giant banks because there's nothing else you can do with them. We just nationalized Chrysler and General Motors. That's another sign of strange things are happening. And I think that kind of rough direction, or take the state of Alaska, again, another example of something odd happening, that the state, unlike Texas, in Alaska, the oil money is divided, the revenues are divided to the people. Again, a public use of resources. So there's something brewing at the grassroots level, and even in some national and state activities in many cities. There are four or 500 cities that are setting up companies to capture the gas from garbage, turning it into electricity and jobs. All, again, some form of democratic ownership. There's something bubbling up that I think over, you know, I'm a historian. I see this in decades. The development of these things are the prehistory, the necessary foundations for a possible bigger advance beyond. That's the way, you know, the women's movement did it. That's the way the civil rights movement did it. That's the prehistory of the New Deal. Or if you look in the 19th century, state by state by state, the women finally got the vote until they got to the national level. And I think that's the way to think about what's happening at the grassroots level now, even as people attempt to do what they can at the national, politically, to do whatever you can, but really thinking about how do we rebuild the base of politics and the institutions underneath it for the long haul.
Except that the pressures against that happening from those with vested interests at the moment and a lot of money to go along with it and a political system that responds to those levers is perhaps unprecedented in its strength.
Well, it is. That's true in one sense, but it's not true in another. And this is what's very interesting. I sometimes put it this way. At the internal empire, if you like, that's the way, Madison talked about it. At the tail end, where things are really at their worst, that's the place where the pain levels are highest. A city like Cleveland, Ohio, for instance, where, you know, the city's gone from 800,000 to 400,000 in the last 20 years, and it's a wreckage everywhere and decay. It's almost abandoned by the powers that be. It's those levels of pain have developed the most interesting models in the country, where there are really exciting and very large-scale worker-owned companies, in part aimed at the purchasing power of hospitals and universities that can't move and have a lot of public money. So the so-called Cleveland model is now happening in many, many cities that don't have a way to solve their problems. That's the key point. The pain levels grow, the problems grow, and the powers that be can't and don't care to solve them and can't solve them because the political system is jammed. That's where you're seeing a lot of experimentation out of pain. And piece by piece, in fact, I think that's where the slow buildup, as always in long-term social change, the powers that be usually oppose, but slowly and agonizingly citizens build. You couldn't have imagined, nobody predicted the Middle East explosions, and there's a long way to go, but no one predicted the American Revolution itself. And there was a long way to go. I'm a realist. It may be that there's no possibility for serious change in America. The options are, no, we're just going to decay, or it could go way to the right in a very ugly way, or it could stagnate for a long time, and out of a stagnation and pain, the rebuilding of new ideas and a new politics, the prehistory of the next great America Beyond Capitalism movement, I think that's the most interesting possibility, and that's where we ought to concentrate our attention on building towards the new, at the same time we do whatever we can with traditional strategies. That's where the action really is. There aren't any other openings. So I've been seeing people say, the light bulb goes on, either we do what we can in traditional ways, and or we build, we have to do that, or we build forward, or the the decay and pain continue. We either try to move in a new direction or the pain continues. And that's the existential choice. Because people can say, well, you know, nothing can be done. And that we all have a vested interest in pessimism. It really means since nothing can be done, you don't have to do anything. Or you say, you know, if you can do it in a city like Cleveland, which is in really terrible conditions, probably we could do something interesting here. And there's a lot of experience to build on that you could draw on from other cities and state banks and city banks and health programs and land trusts and worker-owned companies and co-ops and state ownership. And, I mean, there's an enormous amount of experience that simply isn't covered by the press. And as I say, that's one of the reasons I wrote America Beyond Capitalism, just to report on this, at what people are doing. If you think you can't do something in your local area because the powers will stop you, take a look at this book or take a look at the Internet, and you'll see that lots of people have found a way to do something when they rolled up their sleeves and decided to get going.
And does it have to get as bad or metaphorically as bad as Cleveland in order for these things to happen?
It does not, no. That's I was giving you the extreme case.
Right.
And the place where it's really hard to do, but, you know, there are also very interesting, San Francisco is that one of the councilors I noticed has just proposed setting up a city bank. We've got, I think, $2 billion in city money floating around most of the time. Why should it go to Bank of America? Why not set up a city bank like the state bank that exists in North Dakota or a city credit union and then use that to finance cooperative development in that area? Just across the bay in Richmond, the mayor has set up and put together the first co-op administrator as a city government official to try to improve and develop cooperatives in the city. So these are not areas where there is the kind of pain you see in Cleveland. In these areas, you have a kind of consciousness and awareness that and a sense of experimentation that you can also go in a new direction. So that's what's encouraging about America. They're kind of different environments in which different things can happen.
Is this a bottom-up movement in its entirety, or is it going to take dramatic leadership from above to make it work?
Very good question. I think it is primarily at this stage bottom-up. However, at some point, and this is when it gets interesting and why I like your question, at some point the light bulb goes on, I think, that this is a potentially an important national movement that really has a direction and political leadership. Now, we aren't near there yet. We haven't gotten to that point. People are still struggling and agonizing with the pain of the economy. But I think when consciousness shifts, when people are aware that, in fact, if you look around, there's a lot going on, and then an idea, and then a movement, and then leadership begin moving, that's when the action gets very, very exciting. And as I say, thinking about it as a historian, that process is very common in history. It's not an unusual process. The first people who sat down at a lunch counter in the civil rights movement didn't know they were starting a movement. They didn't know there was a national leadership that would come out of that. But something clicked that people then understood that there was a way to have national strategies and ideas and movements building. So I think that's the next, you know, potentially that's the next stage in all of this. But we're at step one now, just people beginning to be aware of what their friends and neighbors are doing around the country, and then beginning to think it through. The other reason I wrote this book, and it ties in with your question, and why I think talking about an America beyond capitalism explicitly is important. We also need to think through the theory of how we really are how do we organize an advanced post-industrial system? How do you make it democratic? How do you make it egalitarian? And how do you preserve liberty? Those are really important political theory questions, as well as questions about strategy. Really, what do you want? If corporate capitalism and state socialism don't work, really, what do you want? And so partly the book also is a book about, you know, how do we think through that an alternative way that's none of the above, and do it in a serious way. So I urge people, if they get involved, to, you know, form a small, get a half a dozen friends and read something like this and struggle with it. Not only at what could we do tomorrow to build a co-op, but what are we talking about? What is our theory of change? What is the vision we have? How do we get intellectually deep about, you know, the Tea Party for all, and Ron Paul for all of what I think is really quite reactionary ideas, mm-hmm. They have an ideal, and they have a vision, and they have a theory, and it's all about liberty. and they are morally driven because they are secure in their ideas. And I think we need to reassess and come to think through a lot about what we're talking about liberty. You know, the subtitle of America Beyond Capitalism is Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. That is, what is it we really think will allow us to rebuild democracy and liberty? And how do we structure a political economic system that does that? Neither state socialism nor corporate capitalism meet those values. So this is, we're into really serious things if we start talking about how you actually can manifest meaningful democracy and liberty. What is the nature of the system we're building and hope to rebuild in the new century that will give that? And then what are the starting points? How do we move from A to B to C? So it's, this is a book for people who are serious about these things. It's not just casual reading. It's right. A question of how do we get there.
And while we see all of this percolating up from the bottom in various places around the country, is it your sense that there's any real understanding of this anywhere in Washington?
Very little. I think Washington is, as usual, concerned with, I spent, as you may know, the years of managing House and Senate, the legislative staffs for progressive members. They're bombarded with how do you get through the next election? How do you raise enough money to withstand the assault? How do you make incremental small change? All of which is important. Holding the line is important. That's very important. But the notion of kind of building from the bottom up the next political movement, and the content of it, which is not just tax and spend and not just regulate, but really build new institutions that are democratically owned, that content is, some members of Congress, one group has introduced legislation to promote co-ops, and that's a step in this direction. And there's some consideration of doing some further support for worker-owned companies. So there are fragments, and you see people like Bernie Sanders has introduced legislation for a bank for co-ops. So you see fragments beginning to emerge, but the dominant pattern is really how do we struggle to hold the line and not get overwhelmed by the process and the political process. But that's normal in historical change. At the center, that's where the least change happens, where the change really develops is, where folks, I'm from Wisconsin, it happens in cities like my hometown, a struggling city of Racine, Wisconsin, an old industrial town. And it happens in places where, in the Portlands and the San Franciscos, in a different way, from a different consciousness, but not in Washington. That's the last place. We get there last.
And from a historical context, when have we seen situations that call for change as large as this?
Well, obviously, the most the largest, biggest change, the two biggest changes in American history, by far, were the American Revolution. That's number one, where we took on the most powerful army and navy in world history at that point, the British Army and Navy. So that's one change. The second really big one, obviously, was the Civil War, where we took on the question of the ownership of property, in this case, slave property. There have been somewhat lesser changes, which really the New Deal is probably the most important, in which there were a major rebalancing of the political system and creating a new institution. I mean, basically, the labor unions were struggling in 1929 at the 10 to 11% of the labor force. It was the crisis collapse and the New Deal and World War II took it from 10 to 11% of the labor force to build a powerful institutional force that was now 35% of the labor force. That scale. But in one sense, perhaps, and it's hard to really grasp the significance of both the civil rights movement and the feminist movement in modern times. The civil rights movement was extraordinary, and people sense it, but the feminist movement radically reshaped an entire culture. We don't think it's so obvious now that we don't even understand. In the 1940s and 30s and 50s, women couldn't get banking accounts, and they were subject to their husband's rule. And to get a job for a woman was to say, for her, first it meant that her husband was a ne'er-do-well, so she couldn't do it because it would cast aspersions on him. There's been a radical cultural shift. One of the most interesting pieces of data I've seen recently is there's a new poll out by a conservative, a reasonably conservative polling group, Rasmussen.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2009, they surveyed people under 30 as to whether they thought socialism or capitalism was a better system. And really striking was they thought they were equally good or equally bad. They didn't think there was much to choose between them. And that's really striking in America when, you know, I'm older than that. When I was brought up to say that socialism was communism, Joe Stalin was going to get you, and you were a crazy communist if you had any interest in socialism. I don't know whether people are interested in socialism or not, but the idea that you can talk about really big differences of systems, whatever you call them, that's really important. And there was a poll released last 2 weeks ago by the same organization asking the same question of people under 30. Now, remember, people under 30 are the people who are going to build the new society. They're the ones who are going to create mm-hmm. the new society. They're not older folks like me. I'm going to comment at this stage of my life and be activist when I can. But the change had gone in the direction of a more 3 or 4 point trend in the direction of people being more favorable to socialism, the word socialism, than to capitalism. So, again, I don't think that tells you anything about the specifics of the systems. What it tells you is people are open to very different directions. And as I say, my book's called An America Beyond Capitalism, and the direction I'm kind of suggesting is very American, is radically decentralized wherever possible in co-ops and worker-owned companies and municipalities and state-owned strategies, whenever necessary, national and regional structure. But I think people are open to something new, and the polling data, particularly for younger people, quite apart from the current elections, whatever happens, suggests that people know there's something wrong. And, you know, I don't think the Occupy movement would have gotten anywhere if people in general didn't sense something was wrong. And I think that's the first step in saying, hey, we really got to look at the different things. And I think when people begin to look, they're going to find there's an enormous amount going on that you can build on just below the surface of what the press thinks is important or has money to cover or has interest to cover, which it simply doesn't report on all the stuff that's going on.
Gar Alperovitz, his book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.